Okay, so let's say that you see some people call on the name of the Lord, and let's say that you have a simple church going. And by the way, I alluded to this last night, that what we need, again, is it sounds like Paul might be an evangelist. Tell me your name again.
Bill.
Bill, that's right, Bill. Bill might be an evangelist. There might be others here. And the churches need to let the evangelist go and be out there. And once they start, once they have a small group, as quickly as possible, they need to hand that over to somebody else who's a teacher, a discipler. And then they need to move on to another community, because you want to see this thing grow. You want to see it generate. Now, how do you know? Here's a question you might say, well, how do you know if you're an evangelist? How do you know if you're a teacher? How do you know if you're a mercy ministry person? I think the easiest way to know is, what is your motivation? What drives you? What are you energized by? And it's all supernatural, of course, but what comes easy to you? For example, a lot of people would think, and I used to think, that I'm an evangelist. And I don't think that's really true. Now, I enjoy evangelism. And when I'm doing evangelism, I really enjoy it even more. But I have to kind of make myself do evangelism. I have to say, okay, I need to go out and evangelize at the university. I need to establish relationships with unbelievers. And, you know, I have to be very purposeful in it. A real evangelist is just inwardly motivated. They just like to do it. They enjoy it. They're not tired by it. They're energized by it. My gifts would be more in the area of preaching or teaching. And I can do that all day long. You know, and I'm energized by it. Also, I can tell you, mercy ministry is not my gift. It's important. It's as important as these other ministry gifts. Don't think that one's more important than the other. They're all important. Equally so. But when I do mercy ministry stuff, I am exhausted. It just sucks the life out of me. And yet there are other people who are absolutely energized by it. So that's how you know, I think. Now, once you have a few believers, then what do you teach them? Well, let me give you a little background here. So I've been working on this for India and Nicaragua, and I'm thinking, okay, now what can I get these people that's very simple and basic to help them grow in the grace and knowledge of Christ? So I thought about a lot of different things. The bottom line in both Nicaragua and India is this, that to get these people this material is way too expensive. I mean, I don't have the money, and they sure don't have the money for the different discipleship books that we could use. So then my thought was, well, I'll just write my own material. You know, basic stuff on how to pray, how to read the Bible. You know, I've got like 29 outlines of lessons. I've not quite finished it. So that was my plan. I'll make this stuff available in Nicaragua and India. We'll get it translated into Telugu and Spanish and so forth. And then about 2 months ago, I met a guy named Bob McNabb. Bob was a member at Briarwood. He's now a member of Oak Mountain PCA. And he was with Campus Outreach for many, many years. And this guy is a discipler, a multiplier of disciples. And so Chuck Singletary, an older fellow at Briarwood, who was an old-time navigator, gave me a copy of this book, Spiritual Multiplication in the Real World. And
I don't know about y'all, but when you think about when, if y'all were in college ministry when you're at your university, you know, you could be part of RUF or Campus Crusade or whatever it was, and you know, they discipled you. You know, you were in small groups and you learned how to pray and read the Bible and evangelize. Particularly crew in campus outreach when I was in college, they were great at that. The problem was that once you got out into the real world, you didn't have time for that. You know, in college, you know, you're in. Now look, let's face it. Unless you were in a real academic environment, like studying engineering or, you know, pre-med or something, if you're like me, man, I had all kind of time on my hands. You know what I mean? So I'm going to be honest about it. So I could meet, because I was a baseball player, but I could meet just about any time, you know? Well, once you get out of college, you get a job, you know, you got to work and you got your family. It's a different story. And most of the discipling that was effective in college doesn't work in the real world. Hence the title of this book, Spiritual Multiplication in the Real World. So I read this book. I said, this is good. This is the best thing I've ever seen on discipling. And so he's got this book that kind of tells you how to do it. Then he's got another book that is kind of the study guide. And then, this is really interesting too, he's got one called Foundations, which is, okay, what do you do with a brand new believer? What's the first thing you do? This, and by the way, this is all really, really simple stuff. For example, this book, Foundations, My Story, The Gospel, Assurance of Salvation, Following Christ as Lord, Your Identity in Christ, Purpose in Life, Quiet Time, The Word, Prayer, Life in the Spirit, Perseverance and Suffering. Simple. Real simple stuff. And another thing I like about this material, and you can go online and get these books, and I think I've mentioned them in here. So, but another thing I like about them is he's got his material online, and I think you can download it for free. I'm pretty sure on that. Don't hold me to that exactly, but I'm pretty sure that's true. And so right now, he's already got it translated into a number of different languages. So right now, my plan is I'm going to use this stuff because it's so simple. Here's the benefit of it. Here's where we make a mistake. We tend to think that a discipling, the most important thing is knowledge. So we want to fill people's heads with knowledge. Is knowledge important? Well, of course it is. But what does Jesus say? Teaching them to obey all that I commanded you. Lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. And so what McNabb points out is really what you're after in new converts is a new habits that they have to develop. So you want, so yeah, you give them some knowledge, but the real thing is you want to build in them, you should pray, and you should read the Bible, and you should memorize the Scripture, and you should evangelize. Which leads me to my next point, in connection with what all we've been saying. And I say this is a tremendous encouragement to all of us. McNabb would say that the most effective way to do evangelism is in a team concept. What he calls discipleship ministry teams. Now look, these can be any number of things. These can be your prayer meeting that you're part of. They can be your small group men's Bible study or women's Bible study. They can be a very specific discipling ministry. It doesn't matter. But here's the difference. That you're very intentional in being outreach oriented in whatever your small group is. And that you hold each other accountable. Now, sometimes that has a negative connotation. I don't mean it negatively. I mean it as an encouragement. For example, we're part of a Tuesday night revival prayer meeting at Briarwood. There's about 15 to 20 people who come to this meeting. And here's what happens. And it falls into this, what I was saying earlier about revival prayer. When you begin to pray in a revival prayer fashion, God begins to give you a burden for the lost.
And then when you come together in your meetings, you almost instinctively talk about what God's been doing in your life that past week. And people you've met that last week, and people you're praying for. So let me put it this way. Think about whatever small group you're in. Here's the team concept of evangelism. You say, now, let's pray for this next week for God to lead us to people who are open and receptive to the gospel. Let's look for them. It might be at work. It might be in a ball team that you coach, or, you know, any number of things. And then what you want to do is you want to establish a relationship with them. What does that mean? You get to know them. You get their phone number. You start, you know, just hanging out with them. Now, when you come back to your meeting the next week, what Bob McNabb does is he takes a big whiteboard, like a poster board. He says, okay, and each of the members in the group has their name at the top. So now, okay, let's put, did you meet anybody this week that's now a contact? By the way, he defines a contact as you've got their name and phone number. If you just met them and you don't have the phone number, that's no good. A contact is you're being very intentional, very purposeful. So you write their name on the board. And everybody at the end of the meeting, maybe spend 10 minutes, you pray for those people on the list. And you continually are asking God to give you open doors to reach out to these people. You see, again, we're getting, and the benefit of doing it in the team concept is you can encourage one another. Here's another benefit of it. Let's say that you know, you try to be very intentional in your small group meeting. And let's say you got all these names on the board. And let's say that you're coming up to the Super Bowl. Say, hey, why don't we have a get-together on the night of the Super Bowl? And why don't we just invite all those people we've been praying for? Or you might have somebody, you know, come through town who's an athlete or a business person or whatever, who's, you know, who's a speaker. Hey, why don't you come with me to this meeting? You're trying to find ways to invite people. Now, let me give you a personal example here. So, you know, I do a lot of street preaching. I do a lot of one-on-one evangelism. I do door-to-door evangelism. But the thought occurred to me about 2 months ago that I would be really hard-pressed, beyond my family members who don't know the Lord, to write on a whiteboard people I really know that I'm actively involved in trying to evangelize. Okay? Now I want you to think about that for a second. Are there people other than family members that are neighbors, work associates, or whatever, that you could put their name on a whiteboard and say, yes, I am intentionally involved in their lives with the hope down the road at some point to see them come to Christ? I couldn't do that. And I thought, wow, I got to come up with something. So I started thinking about it. I thought, well, you know, how am I going to do that? I said, I travel so much. I said, I'm not going to get a gym membership because I work out at home anyway, you know, running and all that. So I'm not going to do that. I said, I'm really not going to, I thought, well, you know, I could join the A Club. You know, I was a part of the A Club at Alabama Athletic Club, but I don't want to do that. I could become, join the Alumni Club. That probably costs money, so I don't want to do that. I kept thinking, you know, I got to come up with something. Then it dawned on me like 3 days ago. I said, you know, I got all these friends that I played baseball with in high school and at the University of Alabama. I haven't seen some of these guys in 40 years. So I found the numbers of a couple of these guys and contacted them earlier this week. I've got a meeting on Monday with a guy I've not seen in 40 years. I got a meeting, the other one, I haven't actually set it up yet, but we're going to probably meet the following week. And from that, there'll be other guys. Now, what am I going to do at these meetings?
You see, here's what I think we should always do.
I think it's disingenuous to meet somebody and just kind of build relationships and never let them know you're Christian. That's being dishonest, in my opinion. And besides that, whatever you define, whatever you start your relationship on is what you define your relationship by. So if I hope, is anybody in here still with Amway? I don't want to offend anybody. Okay, but you know what I'm talking about. So I remember years ago, I'd get a phone call from somebody that I haven't seen in 20 years. Hey, would you come by the house Monday night? Why just come on by? So I'd show up, you know, whoa, they got this big Amway presentation. I felt like I was hoodwinked, you know what I'm saying? And I didn't feel like they were being honest with me. They should have said, look, this is an investment opportunity with Amway. Do you want to do it? No. Okay, fine. Or yes, I'll be there. And so sometimes I think Christians are that way. They're not really up front, you know? And it's disingenuous. So what should you do? Well, I think you should get Jesus on the scoreboard early on. And what do I mean by that? You don't need to say, hey, you know, I'm a Christian. What about you? If you die today, you're going to hell or hell. You know, maybe you can do that, but that's not necessary. But what you can do is what I'll do with these guys I meet, because I think they already know I'm a Christian anyway, because you know, it's been a long time, but I think they know. So I'll say, yeah, you know, I'm a pastor, you know, and I've been doing this, I've been doing that, and, you know, God's really worked in my life. I'm telling them my story. Notice how many times Paul, at least three times in the book of Acts, gives us a conversion story. That's powerful. We should do that. Just tell them what God's done in our life. They can't dispute it. So my point is that we've got to find ways to get into people's lives. So evangelism is not just door-to-door. It's not just preaching on the streets or whatever. That's fine. But it's also a way of life. Getting out of our comfort zone and reaching out to people. So those are some final points I want to make on that. Okay, let's move on here to officer training. Now, part of this is in the context of India or Nicaragua, but I also believe we can make a very practical application to today. All right, so we're planting these churches in India. I have no intention of developing a theological seminary for these guys. I'm not. There is a PCA seminary in Dehradun, India, and it may be that some of those guys go there. See, I think seminary can be very helpful, but seminary can be most helpful and that academic rigor for those whom God has equipped to be professors or scholars or that sort of thing. Yes, by all means, we need that. But I don't think the ordinary pastor necessarily has to have that depth of theological understanding and training. Now, I know that kind of flies in the face of our Reformed tradition, and I do realize that doctrine is important. Absolutely. And there's heresies out there everywhere. But think about it like this. I was at a meeting about a month ago with several African-American pastors in the PCA and a guy that's over a Hispanic ministry in the PCA. And I said, as I mentioned last night, we are woefully weak in reaching in to these minority cultures. I said, we've got to do a better job. If the PCA must reach into these minority cultures for two reasons. We've got to be effective. Number one, for sheer survival. I go to a lot of churches in Alabama, for example, that are small, struggling churches, and they are dying. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to admit it, but they're dying. And I say to these elders, I said, if you do not evangelize anyone and everyone, you will die. Your church will shut down. It's just a matter of time. Look at the demographic. You're 70 years old. You've got 30 people left. What's going to happen? You know? And the people don't want to face the music. You know? But they got to. But secondly, it's the right thing to do. The gospel breaks down division. Paul in Ephesians chapter 2 makes it clear the middle wall of division has been broken down between Greek and Gentile, circumcised and uncircumcised. In Colossians he says, there's no longer barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is in all, and Christ is all and in all. The fact is that all, you know, and we say this in a trite way, but it's absolutely the truth. The only thing that can break down the division and the strife in our culture, and by the way, it's not just in our culture, it's in every culture in the world, is the gospel. I know we say it, but I'm telling you, it's the only thing that'll work. The only thing. And so we've got to do a better job. So, I was meeting with Alton Hardy on Tuesday. Alton's an African-American pastor in Fairfield. He's in the hood. It's amazing what this guy's, what God's doing through him. It's just so thrilling. It's thrilling. I was at church on Sunday afternoon with him, and I met a guy. Of course, I heard about this guy. He was a murderer. You know, now he's out, and he's in the church. That's beautiful. You know, this guy wants to be a pastor. Now, I don't even think he has a high school degree. Now think about it for a second. We're going to ask this guy who's been in the hood all his life. We're going to ask this guy not only to get his GED, but now we're going to ask the guy to go to college for 4 years. And then we're going to ask him to go to seminary for 3 or 4 years. And by the time he gets out of seminary, guess what? He doesn't want to stay in the hood. He doesn't want to go back to the hood. And you see it all the time. I see it. There was a guy that we brought to the United States from Uganda one time. He swore he was going to go back. He promised he was going to go back. I didn't pay, but I had friends who paid his way through Covenant College, through Covenant Seminary. He would go back to Uganda every summer to minister, which was good. Then he met a Ugandan woman, which is fine. He got married. He brought her to St. Louis. Guess where they are now? St. Louis. Actually in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh. But they didn't go back home. I don't blame them. You know what I'm saying? I get it. I totally get it. But the mistake was to bring them here in the first place. They almost never go back. There are some exceptions, but they almost never do. And so all I'm saying is that we've got to come up with a better way of training these men. Here's what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that we should lower the standards. That's an insult. What you're saying there is they can't handle it. They can't handle the academic rigor. Yes, they can. But all I am saying is we've got to come up with a better way. And thankfully in the PCA we have what's called the Extraordinary Clause. And we can ordain men without a formal theological education or even a university education. It's exceedingly rare, but it can be done. And so we are working through how to do that. There's the LAMP program, maybe you've heard of that. That's one way to do it. But we're trying to come up with a way, because like Alta's got 6 guys right now. A couple of them were with that campus outreach at Troy State, some of these other universities, but a couple of these guys never went to college. And what we don't want to do is, see, here's the thing. These guys, these black guys who've gone to college, they've got regular jobs now. And their plan was, we'll stay in Fairfield for a year because Alton got a couple of houses bought, you know, and these guys are living together. And the idea was they're giving their expertise in campus outreach ministry to the young guys in the church. It was awesome. But they're playing along with it. Hey, I'll give it a year, but I'm out after a year, man. I want to live like everybody else lives. But now they've been there for a couple months. They're buying in. You know, man, we see what this is really like. So they want to stay in the hood. They want to minister in the hood. So we want to be careful. Now, some of these guys might be scholars. And if so, by all means, they need to go to a Covenant or a Westminster or wherever. And they need to get the postgraduate degree. I get all that. That's fine. But that's not for everybody. We don't need that for everybody. And in the context of India, I have no intention of sending these guys off to get a seminary degree somewhere. We're going to train them. But we are half third millennium. You know, Richard Pratt's material, all of that. It's all good stuff. So I'm saying all that to say that there's ways we want to train elders and deacons and pastors. But we start with this basic material. New believers go through this. And as time goes on, you know how it is. Leaders begin to rise to the top. You just know. There's certain people that just kind of rise above. And everybody knows this guy's a leader. How do you know a leader? A leader is where somebody follows him. That's how you know a leader. And when those leaders rise up, then you begin to give them some specific training, a little more theological training, you know, informal or maybe formally, but that's what you want to do. Let's talk a little bit about, any questions about that before we go on? Okay, I want to talk about personnel, and I want to use military metaphors here, a metaphor, because that kind of helps me understand the hierarchy of what we're trying to do. So I talk about generals and colonels and so forth. So, all right, so what's the general? Now, again, let's put it into your practical situation. I'm thinking now of Paul, and I'm thinking of Lincoln and Scott and David, three men who I know are pastors and one who wants to be a pastor. Okay, so there's a sense in which, see, what we're after here is a church planting movement. Not just one church. I would like to see David, over time, plant several churches in around the Dothan area. It doesn't take a lot of money. It doesn't take church buildings. They'd probably be all small churches, you know. Doesn't matter. Same with Scott. So, you guys would be what I would call the general, the visionary leader. It takes someone with some vision who's going to lead the way. This is the little A apostle, as it were. Now, you can't walk around and call yourself Apostle David, right? Like some churches do. You know, you can't do that. But you're the guy who develops the plan of attack. He obviously seeks counsel from the colonels and the lieutenants. But he's the one who communicates the vision. God gives him the vision, and it may differ from place to place. Here's the beauty of it all. Have you ever thought about this? Jesus did not give detailed, specific marching orders of how to do it. It's general. The Apostle Paul, you can glean his methodology. He obviously, especially by the time of the second missionary journey, went to the big cities. But still, there's no detailed plan of attack that the apostles or the Lord Jesus gave us. They gave us general principles to use. And so this is the way it is here. I'm giving you some general stuff, but it might look different in and around Jasper and in Hayneville and so forth. It may look a lot different than it would be in Dothan. But there's the general principles that are involved. So the general develops the plan of attack. Again, he gets the counsel of his colonels and lieutenants. He communicates it. And here's the big thing. This is what's hard.
He has to hold his officers accountable. Look, it is our natural inclination to want to coast, right? It is. You know, the great football coaches, the great basketball coaches are given to detail. And they make sure that the detail, that the people are held accountable to the details. I've watched my son coach his basketball team, and if a guy is running a drill incorrectly and his footwork is not exactly right, stop. Okay, you got to do that again. I thought, it's okay, it was close enough. No, do it exactly right. You see, Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, that's the same way. You know, detail, attention to detail. So, holding people accountable. The colonel...
Hey, Alan,
yes, go ahead.
General, does that mean to be... So, is there a gift that tends to accompany the general, the three that you mentioned, mercy, teaching, or evangelist?
I think it can be either one.
It can be any of those three.
Yeah, I think if you look, it's interesting. Let me give you a couple examples. Think of Perimeter Church. Think of Jack Miller and the New Life Churches in Philadelphia. Think of Coral Ridge in Fort Lauderdale. Think of, again, Jack Miller's ministry, Sonship. Think of Campus Crusade for Christ with Bill Bright. All of these men were... are those still living, are evangelists. Now, I'm not saying that you can't have teachers in these roles, but those guys were evangelists. And here's what happens. When the evangelist dies off, the ministry changes. It just does. Sonship now is more of a teaching ministry than it is an evangelizing ministry. Do they still do evangelism? Yes. But it's not driven. The culture, the ethos, is not first and foremost evangelism. Same is true of Coral Ridge. Of course, when Jim Kennedy died, the whole thing fell apart. And Campus Crusade, while it's still a great ministry, Steve Douglas, the leader, is not an evangelist. Well, I can tell he's a great administrator, a great leader. But even Cruz changed to some degree. I don't think it has the direct intentional evangelistic thrust that it did 30 years ago. So my point is that by all means it can be all three. But if it's a teacher, then he needs to understand he really needs to have an evangelist right beside him. Because the evangelist is the one who will keep... The evangelist, think of it like this, is the spear point to the ministry. Another analogy would be he's leading the troops in the battle. Now, we need the teaching, and these guys have got to be trained. That's where the teacher comes in. And then people get hurt and they get injured in battle, so that's where the mercy ministry guys come in. But if he's a teacher or mercy ministry guy leading, he's got to have the advantage. And the other ministry gift right next to him, moving forward. Good question.
Therefore, it followed that, because you mentioned, so... Lincoln, Scott, David, Paul, Lynn. Yeah. You would need to be a pastor in the general, a pastor or pastor, you know, whatever, in that general role, or can it be a ruling elder?
I think it could be a ruling elder. I think practically speaking, while we certainly have parity in the PCA between ruling and teaching elders, we know that the pastor is the moderator of the session generally, and we know that that's, you know, the congregation typically looks to him. It can be a ruling elder, but I think probably 9 times out of 10 it's going to be a teaching elder. It's going to be the pastor, but it could be the other. Especially if you've already got a church planting movement going, and the pastor leaves to go to another church, then who's going to keep it going? So hopefully you've got some ruling elders who can keep it going. Yeah. Okay. All right. The colonel would be the field general, the indigenous leader. For example, in India, it's this guy, Dasan Yiraj. In
Nicaragua right now, it's a missionary named Emerson Wilson. And he's got a couple of guys, one guy, Richard Fuentes, who I think's really got a lot of potential. Those would kind of be, you know, the colonels that are kind of heading that up. So, for example, in India, you know, I'm a Skype calls with Dasan about every couple of weeks. All right, how's it going? Bring me up to date on where we are, that kind of thing. And in this particular situation, it might be, for example, David gets one or two men in the church, or maybe somebody, a young guy, maybe who's not in pastoral ministry yet, but is thinking about it. Maybe, see, David's got his own ministry. He can't be at these other places all day, every day. He can't be that. So he's got people on the ground, so to speak, who are doing more of the day-to-day operation of the church and leading others who might be under him. By the way, this is another great way to develop leaders in the church. Okay, so what is the qualification for leadership? Obviously, at that level, because we're talking about pastors or evangelists or whatever, there's the biblical qualifications, 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1. But there's got to be some leadership gifts that are clearly seen. The general is going to be the keeper and the promoter of the vision. Again, being able to hold people accountable to sustain the culture of church planting. As I read about these guys in other cultures, it's amazing. These are not dynamic people. Necessarily, they're not what you might typically think of as a loud, boisterous, upfront leader. They just work with people, and they work behind the scenes, and they're very methodical in training and equipping people. Here's what I'm not saying: I'm not saying that the pastors here are supposed to go out and do all the work. We're to equip the saints for the work of service. I'm saying that we spread, that we delegate, that we learn to delegate, that we learn to trust other people. Give them the opportunity to succeed or to fail. Give them some training, but then you send them out. Give them the freedom. Do not micromanage them. The lieutenants. I'm suggesting these are the evangelists and also the teaching and ruling elders. Now, how do you find evangelists? If you've got an evangelist in your church, then you should urge him to go out regularly and to take other people with him. The benefit, I think, of door-to-door evangelism is there's several reasons why I think it's beneficial. One, it's very intentional. Number two, you're asking God to lead you to people of peace, so you're looking for God to do that. Thirdly, let's face it, in order to evangelize, in order to be fruitful, Jesus says, until a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it will not bear fruit. We have to die. This is the benefit of door-to-door evangelism and street preaching. You're making yourself vulnerable. You're saying, here I am, and I'm willing to suffer ridicule. I'm willing to suffer rejection. I'm willing to be humbled. That's the way. And I think that's a great benefit. But another benefit of it, it's a great training tool. So the evangelist, how does he find other evangelists? He takes people with him. Now, when he takes people with them, some people will say, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, I'm done. You know, I'll find something else to do. That's not my thing. But there will be some who will love it. We had our Samuel Davies conference on evangelism recently. And there's a young guy that came there from Columbia Bible College, and he'd never been street preaching before. And they were at the Bristol 500 in Bristol, Tennessee. The guy caught fire. This guy now wants to become a full-time evangelistic preacher. He's preaching every Wednesday at the University of South Carolina. He's one of my friends a week ago and says, I was made for this. I love this. Now, for most of us, whoa, I'm not made for that man. I want nothing to do with that. But you see, the gift popped out. He didn't know he had that gift. He didn't know he was an evangelist. It popped out. And that's what will happen for some, not all. So the way that we find them is you send them out under the leadership of an evangelist, and certain people will rise to the top as evangelists. Then you got to train them. You notice how Jesus, Luke says, then in Luke chapter 1, he says, I'm going to report all that Jesus did and taught. Not taught and did and taught. Okay? So the way that you train people is you take them with you and they watch what you do. And then when they watch what you do, then they begin to realize, well, I got a lot to learn here. I'm not quite ready for this. I need to learn some more. And then you teach them. They need to realize that they need some training. Then deploying them. Again, I think it's got to be systematic. You should have a regular visitation program. And again, it's the context of church planting. It's not just we're sending people out to do some evangelism. No, it's in the context. We want to go to this particular city here. We want to go to this particular community, this particular town. We're going to do evangelism there. Let's find these people who've been trained. They've been called. Let's send them out. And again, this doesn't have to be some grandiose plan. Maybe it's 1 hour a week. Listen. We're all busy. We can't devote, 24/7 to this. I'm just saying we might have to make some priorities, Instead of being home every night watching Fox News and lamenting how bad the world is. Right? Maybe we could give one night a week to go out and evangelize. In a particular community. And let me say this, that unless you're an evangelist in your flesh, you don't want to do it. Can we be honest here? You don't want to do it. And so what happens is you'll come up with reasons why you don't need to do it. I'm tired tonight. I got something else I need to do. You always find something good to do. It's not like you're going to go do some horrible sin as opposed to evangelize. No, it might be something really good. But it's subtle how it works on us. Then we need to certify them. That is, as time goes on, we say this person really is a gifted evangelist, and so you begin to multiply your ministry in that way. Or it might be teaching, it might be mercy ministry. Then we could talk about the same thing with teaching and ruling elders. We know they're to shepherd, they're to govern. There ought to be parity between elders, teaching elders, and ruling elders. And then the credentialing, I've already sort of alluded to that. I think we got to find a better way to credential ministers for the gospel. I think we need to, again, some ought to go to seminary. RTS, Covenant, whatever, great, not a problem. But if we want to reach into the minority culture, particularly with people with a lesser education, then we've got to come up with another plan. And that's kind of the stuff we're working on. Now, I'm not the only one working on it. There's a lot of guys in the PCA who see this. They see there's a real need for this. So that's down the road, hopefully. I call the sergeants deacons. I'm thinking logistics here. A lot of the sergeants in the Army, they have logistical jobs. Deacons are involved in caring, sharing, and showing mercy. They're to care for the people in the church. They might see a difference would be this. My wife and I went to visit the other day a woman named Phyllis at Briarwood. Phyllis is probably in her mid-70s or so. She was in our prayer meeting, our revival prayer meeting on Tuesday night. She's a lovely Christian woman. She lost her husband a number of years ago. She's a prayer warrior. She is... the joy of the Lord is on her face. She's dying of lung cancer. She didn't smoke. I'm not sure how she got it. She's in a hospice right now. And so we went to see her the other day, and you know, we know she loves the Lord. We know she's looking forward to heaven. So we didn't sidestep the issue. We started talking about the glory of heaven, that which is awaiting her. She's all, you know, all excited about it. So there's a sense in which when Winnie and I went to her room the other day, we were caring for her. We gave a little bit of time, and we were genuinely interested. We were caring for her. Now, what's interesting is she has a friend from when she used to live in Arkansas. This woman apparently has lost her husband as well. And so when Phyllis realized she had lung cancer, she called her friend and said, "Would you come live with me?" Basically, "Would you be here while I die?" Now, her friend has taken it to a new level. She's not just caring for her friend. She's sharing with her. She's given up where she was living to live with Phyllis 24/7 until she dies. That's pretty amazing. So she's caring and she's sharing right now. Now, Phyllis doesn't seem to be in a lot of pain right now. I mean, she's able to walk around, you know, and everything. But very quickly, she's going to become bedridden. Okay? And that's when her friend will begin to show mercy. You know? Caring, sharing, and showing mercy. You see the difference? And these are all aspects of mercy ministry. And the deacons are to be over that kind of thing. Okay, so what about the corporals then? We're going down the line here. The corporals are simple church leaders. Now, here's what I mean. Let's say that David and some people from the church here, after you've prayed and you've done the revival prayer, and you're asking God to lead you to people of peace, and you found a community that you believe is open, you know, needy, there's no reformed witness in that community, whatever it is, and so you believe this is where you should go, and so you go and you're looking for the man of peace or the woman of peace, and you're evangelizing and you get a small group going, then what in the simple church? Well, this is where the beauty of developing leaders comes in, because the corporal can be the leader of a simple church. Now, this person, particularly in India or Nicaragua, here's what I'm thinking. I don't think it's necessary here. But in that context, let's say that one of our church planters goes into a new village and he leads to Christ the Hindu. And he says, "Now I want you to bring your people into the house again tomorrow, and I'm going to teach them." Now let's say we've got 8 or 10 new converts. They're all former Hindus. And this guy that you led to the Lord shows some leadership potential. And here's what I would do. This is what the missiologists are doing. They're saying, all right, let's say that one of these 7 guys that I'm working with is the pastor. He gets with this guy who's a new convert. He says, "Okay, now I want to teach you this material right here. In fact, tomorrow we're going to meet together, and I'm going to teach you. I'm going to teach you first lesson, which is my story. And we're going to go through this, and there's some Bible verses in here that you learn, you know, that kind of thing." Okay, so now I'm teaching you this now, and now 2 days from now, I want you to teach this to the people in your small group. Wait a second, the guy's only been a Christian for 2 days. Think about it. You ever notice this? That Paul is in Ephesus on his third missionary journey. Acts chapter 19. He tells us he's there for 2 years. And then from there we know that he went back through Macedonia down to Achaia, where the church of Corinth was. And on his way back, he stopped off at Miletus, which is not far from Ephesus. And Acts chapter 20 tells us that he had his farewell address with the elders from Ephesus. That couldn't have been more than a year later. Paul had appointed elders in Ephesus within a year or so of actually being there. He tells Titus to appoint elders in every city. So, my point is, and Roland Allen brings this out in his book, The Spontaneous Expansion of the Early Church. And he wrote this in 1925. He says, we got it all wrong. So we get this African who's converted, comes to Christ. We bring him into the English compound. We make an Englishman out of him. And then we send him back into the bush. Guess what? He can't relate anymore. He's just like an Englishman. He can't relate. And he said, not only that, we train him for 7 or 8 or 10 years. Is that really necessary? In some cases, yeah. When he's a gifted scholar, yeah, of course. We need African theologians. We need Indian theologians, by all means. We need African-American theologians. I agree with that completely. But not everybody. We've got to get past their tradition. That's not what went on in the early church. There's no way that went on. See, the Spirit of God was moving so quickly. I mean, things are happening like that. And we are like the elephant, you know, maybe after 2 years or 10 years, we got one church, you know. Did you know Michael Youssef, you know, the Church of the Apostles in Atlanta? And he has a very significant ministry in the Muslim world. You know what he said recently? That one Muslim every 15 seconds is coming to Christ in this world. Every 15 seconds. The largest, the fastest growing church in the world is in Iran. It's underground. God is doing a great work. Do you think these people are training their leaders for 5 and 6 and 8 years before they send them out in the ministry? No way. Boom, 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 they're moving. And that's the way I think we should do it. So the corporals would be simple church leaders. In this context here, maybe you don't have to go exactly that way. Maybe you've got young men in your church, maybe right out of college. Maybe they're in their 20s who really have a heart for ministry. You say to them, let me give you some training here. Let's go through this material, you know, make sure you know how to use this stuff. And we're going to lead with evangelists. And then we want you to work with these people. You become, as it were, the pastor of the simple church. You're discipling them. You're encouraging them. And by the way, if you run into something you don't know how to handle, we'll get you some help. You know? This is how guys learn to do ministry. You get them involved. And so you're developing leaders all the way down the line. The privates in this metaphor would be the foot soldiers. These are the ones in this new group who are part of the simple church. These are the ones, boots on the ground, who are actually speaking to their family members and friends, saying, I don't really know a whole lot right now, but God has changed my life. I'm getting some victory over my addictions now, and I really want to try to serve God. I'm learning, but can I tell you what I've learned so far? You know? So these are the people that are part of the Simple Church, and they're evangelizing, they're speaking the truth, they're encouraging the saints. And here's what the privates have to do. See, we got to constantly keep before the people multiplication. See, we got to change our mindset. I know that Americans talk about multiplication. You've heard this old story. If you lead one person to Christ this year, and you disciple that person the next year leads somebody to Christ, you keep it going. Within 7 years or so, the whole world comes to know Jesus. That sounds nice, but nobody does that. You know, that doesn't happen. But what I'm saying is that we've got to develop a culture of multiplying, constantly keeping it in front of the people. We want to see these churches. We want to see lots of Simple churches planted. I'll give you another example. It's amazing. Curtis Sargent, the Southern Baptist guy, grew up on the mission field and I think in Korea. And after he was grown, he and his wife went to some remote island off the coast of China. And I think it had 5 million people at the time, and there were no churches. And he thought, okay, well, let's say that I lead, 10 people a week to Christ. And I'm here for 20 years. I've, you know, maybe impacted 2,000 or 3,000 people. And yet by that time, the island will probably be 10 million people. They're losing ground, man. That's not going to work. We've got to come up with a different plan. And so that's when he started working on the stuff. I got some of the stuff I'm talking about from him. So then a couple of years ago, he went to India. And I believe I'm right on this to say there are 32 states in India. Here's what he did. He found a Christian leader from each of the states. And he took them through training like what I'm talking about right now. And then he said, now, there are 500 districts or counties in India. He said to these 32 guys, now let's divide up these counties or districts, okay? You've got 15, you've got 20, whatever. Now your job is to get a Christian leader from each of these districts or counties. You bring them together and you give them the training. And now each of these guys over a district or a county is to go back, and then you find the subsets, you know, like a particular town or whatever. And then you train a person from each of these districts in this material. Finding a person of peace, simple churches, and that sort of thing. So that's what they did. In 2 years, guess how many simple churches were established in India? 2 years. 1.7 million. 1.7 million. You know, now again, it's a revival culture. We would have some problems with that because they obviously don't have much of an ecclesiology. You know? And so we can tweak that by saying, okay, you got the simple churches, but they still need to become regional churches. And they still need to have governors. They still need to have elders. They still need to have deacons. But we can make that happen. That's not the issue. The point is that they broke it down into sizable chunks to make a difference. And in summary, what I want to suggest is that we're here because you have at least some interest in church planting. And again, the traditional methodology, we raise a lot of money, that's fine. I'm all for that. But we got to do a lot more. And I want to challenge y'all to really believe God. And I'll help you any way I can. But I want us to, as Bob McNabb says, think big, begin small. Think big. Wouldn't it be magnificent if we could begin, if we could see another 100 PCA churches all over the state of Alabama, in small towns, in African American, Hispanic communities. Their worship's very different, perhaps. They meet in the storefront. They don't have a big building. Doesn't matter. Get past all that. Wouldn't it be great to see God do that kind of work? And you got to think big, but you got to start small. Discipleship. Small group prayer leading up to discipleship. And then growing from there. So probably the last thing I want to say is on accountability. It's down the chain of command. You've got the general, then you've got the colonels, and you've got the officers on down. It starts with the leader. He's got to have some accountability. He's got to have metrics in place. What do I mean by that? Say what?
Quantification.
That's right, quantification. For example, this sounds wooden, perhaps. Some would say this is legalistic, but this is the way you get things done in the business world. You have metrics. You quantify. What did you do this past week? For example, one of the things, I'm going to have a phone call in the next week or so with the guys in Nicaragua, and I don't think they're doing a whole lot. And in fact, I've even told them, I said, I'm not sure I'm coming back. I said it nicely, of course, but I said, I'm not sure I'm coming back unless I see something happen. And so I'm going to write them, and I'm going to say, okay, here's the deal. I'll come back, but I want to see these three pastor / church planters. I want measurable, quantifiable action. I want you to be able to tell me that you're spending, these guys don't have big churches, okay? We're talking like 10 or 15 people in the church. It's not like they got a big pastoral responsibility, all right? So I'll say, I want you to spend 20 hours a week in the barrio. And I want you to be able to tell me I've talked to 100 people or I've talked to 50 people about Christ one-on-one directly this week. And how many people called on the name of the Lord? Again, God's got to do the work. How many people are in a simple church? That's what has to happen. That's what happens in the business world. You can be in a meeting and you come up with a plan, okay, we're going to do that, and then nobody holds anybody accountable. They're probably not going to get a whole lot done. It's got to be quantifiable metrics. And so I think that's, and that's, again, that comes back down to the leader. Because, you know, he has to, in the church context, we're going to be nice about it. After all, we can't fire them. They're not paying any money, so you can't hardly fire them. But at the same time, look, you know, do we mean business or not? And it always gets back to this. This is how you start everything. You lay it out on the front end. Why are we here? What is the purpose of our lives? Are we just here to live large and go to church, you know, and put our money in the plate and go on vacation and rear our children and grandchildren? Oh yeah, those are all good. But why are we here? We're here to make disciples. Everybody. Now, once you really buy into that, that begins to affect your priorities. Now, all of a sudden, it's not about you. It's about other people. It's not about your comfort. It's not about laying around the house at night. Now, again, do we need to do that? So, of course we do. Everything's in moderation, you know. You got all this other stuff. But that's the foundation. You got to get back to that. And so when people buy in, Now, they don't buy in, then they'll just move on, which brings me to another point in just a second. But if they buy in on the front end, and if they're kind of slacking off, you can say in a nice way, now remember what we committed to. We committed to X number of weeks. It might be 2 hours a week, whatever it is. We committed to that. Which leads me to another point. Now, it would be great if every member of the church, your church, is bought in. That would be marvelous. But, I mean, look around. We hardly got anybody here. Right. Now, I know there's reasons some people can't be here. But the bottom line is, for whatever reason, most people in the church today are just here. They're not really serious about this stuff. So, what do you do with it? Well, it's like I was telling my wife. She's been doing some discipling, and she was frustrated, and she couldn't get the church to move forward with all this. I said, listen, start with who you got. It doesn't have to be big. Don't worry about the church structure. Start with who you got. So here's what you do. You appeal to the people in your church. We'd love for you to be a part of it. Here's what we want to do. Here's what we expect. Love for you to do it. Are you in or out? Say nicely, of course, I'm in. Okay, great. Most of the people won't do it. Okay, they just won't. So what do you do then? Don't get mad at them. Don't judge them. Don't think you're better than they are. Just move on. Then what do? You find the people out in the world who now being converted. They're the ones. They're excited. It's like Paul and I were talking earlier, you know. He's excited about this stuff. And he's, you know, kind of a tough thing, you know, background. And so these are the people who generally are really hungry. Because you see, they've not been corrupted by the status quo church. They don't know that. They're excited about what God's done in their lives. So, yes, start with the church, but if you don't see much happen, don't worry about it. Find you some new believers. Work with them. That's my example. And
let's see, anything else here? No, that's pretty much it. So, any questions? Thrown a lot at you.
Is it doing the right things or doing things right, or some compromise in between? Perfectionistic people are slow to move. I think PCA is full of perfectionists.
Yeah. I think part of it is that, but also